everyone, and welcome to this panel, Super Metroid, 30 Years of Baby Saving, starring My Life in Gaming and myself, Jeremy Parrish, although I don't have a name up there, it's just Super NES Works. Guys, please introduce yourselves, because your names are not My Life in Gaming.
I am Tri from My Life in Gaming. We're a YouTube channel that, you know, does stuff, mostly retro stuff.
And I'm Corey, the other half of the creative team on My Life in Gaming.
And Super NES Works is a YouTube video series that hasn't updated in about 5 years, so I don't even know why I'm putting that logo up there. But just to, I guess, tantalize everyone who's waiting for me to get to the 1992 chronology.
But also books, yes.
Also books, yeah. And the books haven't been, there hasn't been a new one in like 4 years.
Well, so. You know.
Yeah, it's whatever. But that's okay, because we're talking about really, timelessness. So what is even time? 30 years ago, Super Metroid came out. It's hard to believe that it's been that long if you are like us. I don't know. Were you guys there when it happened? Do you remember the moment that the impact when it hit
100%.
The stores?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was a couple of years later. I mean, I can tell the story if you want.
Actually, I just saw Samus Aran walking behind us. Maybe she should tell the story.
Oh, wow. How about that?
No? Okay. Didn't mean to put you on the spot there. Sorry, Samus. Yeah, please, go on. Let's hear your tales of Super Metroid.
Oh, yes. I mean, I bought it day one. I wanted it because I saw an incredible screenshot of a giant crate in EGM, and I knew that I had to have it because it was 32 meg, you know, twice as big as Street Fighter II.
And, was it actually that much bigger than Street Fighter 2?
Well, I mean, just the memory size.
The box definitely sure. promotes yeah. like the meg size.
It was also the first box that said only on Nintendo.
In the GUI letters.
The GUI, yeah, the GUI
play
slime
loud.
Letters. Yeah. Like Nintendo, they felt they had to fight back against Sonic, I guess, and their solution was to just kill a bunch of innocent people and leave the baby sitting there. I don't know. It's a wild choice. But what about you, Trey?
So funny enough, my local rental store was getting rid of Super Nintendo games to make way for Dreamcast games.
So you came in a little later to the store.
Yeah, okay. So they were making way for Dreamcast games, $19.99, complete copy in the box, $6. Great condition. The only flaw with that copy, though, there's a little sticker, like a little residue from like a silver rental store sticker on the side, and I was just like, I couldn't bring myself to take it off because it's like, now that store is gone, and it's like, you know, I can't get rid of that history. Funny story about that, though, that involves you, Jeremy.
Me?
You.
Did I go to that video rental store?
No, you did not. Okay. It was in Delaware.
I did not go.
They, you were in our Analog Frontiers documentary mm-hmm. series, and you were telling a story about Super Metroid, so I shot some B-roll of my shelf and pulling the game off the shelf, and someone left a comment on that video saying, is anyone else triggered by the gunk that's on Jeremy Parrish's copy of Super Metroid? And I had to reply, saying them straight. I said, that's mine. I'm sure Jeremy Parrish's copy of Super Metroid is pristine.
You know, actually, when I you know, photograph and take images of books or games for books, I tend to leave them in the state that they were in. I don't Photoshop them because I feel like there is a story behind
Absolutely.
Every game.
And that's why.
In that case, that game was rented by a lot of people, and I wonder if any of them ever actually finished. I wonder if any of them figured out what happens when Samus rolls into a ball and there's like a circle of light around her. Because you see all kinds of interesting stuff in this attract mode that's not actually explained in the manual. And if you let it run for a while, which I never actually did when I owned the game, but then I saw it running at a store, like a Walden Software or something, and I was like, what is all this stuff happening? She's like streaking across the air. She's mm-hmm. like tucked into a ball exploding. What's happening?
We were talking about that last night because I don't think that it tells you, it doesn't tell you how to actually do it. They kind of, like the little creatures will show you how to do it, kind of. But I mean, I didn't, when I first played through it, I did not know how to even do any of that stuff. And you don't even need it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if you get stuck where those animals to teach you.
Yeah, well, the wall jumping, yes.
Yeah, there's a safe point down there. You better learn it. When
you have to learn, or otherwise that's the end of your game.
Yeah,
right.
But the shine sparking, it doesn't tell you how to do it, and you don't even need shine spark, as far as I mean, know. Like in
unless you fall down that pit.
In which case, but can't you do the you can wall jump out of it.
No, it's a pretty wide pit. I don't think you can do that. And anyway, you have to like learn some sort of technique in order to get out of that space.
I like the spirit of that. I like the kind of the, you know, I think it's very much in the spirit of something like, say, Dark Souls today, where they hide all these things in the game where, you know, they put a lot of effort into it, but you may or may not see it. A lot of esoteric stuff like that. I really like that, although at the same time, I will say, I think wall jumps feel bad in Super Metroid.
They're not great.
There's not enough visual or audio feedback. Like, I really want like a nice, like, click or something, and you know, Samus's pose is very—it's very difficult to pull off. Shine sparking, like especially in some of the later games where it's like actually required to get some of the really difficult items. Shine sparking kind of annoys me. It kind of feels like there's kind of this like, ooh, it feels really good to pull off, but it's like actually just kind of annoying how you do it. I think it's a little convoluted. I don't get a lot of enjoyment out of shine sparking, but you know, in this game, mostly an optional technique.
So I'm sure some of you might be wondering, what are they even talking about? And so we should actually do this properly and introduce the game. Although I do want to ask, who out there played Super Metroid when it first came out? Who remembers picking it up those early days and just getting lost in the game? Did you get lost in the game? Did you spend time wondering, what am I supposed to do now? You can say, yes, Jeremy, you're correct. That's right. All right.
That's what happened to me in 1999. I started it and I was like, because even then, it was still a relatively fresh experience, mm-hmm. I would say. And
yeah.
I'd never really played anything like that before. I hadn't played, like, Symphony of the Night yet. And I was like, I don't know where to go. This is interesting. I don't know if I'm really enjoying this. And then I started it again several months later, and then it clicked. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is amazing. Every game should be designed like this. And then
every game is designed
every like that. Indie developer got that idea, and now every game is designed like that, and it's too much. I'm burnt out on it.
Yeah.
You just got to take a break and step back, and then go back to the original and appreciate how good it was.
Yes.
Super Metroid really was, like I said earlier, a timeless game. It's 30 years old now, but it still feels very fresh in a lot of ways, even though so many games have imitated it. And it really stood out at the time because it was so different than everything that was out there, you know, for people to pick up. If you look at what Nintendo was publishing and what people were publishing on Super NES in 1994, there was nothing like Super Metroid. I mean, within Nintendo's own library, it feels really different. I mean, like, I keep going back to the dead scientist that you're about to see again here in Ceres Space Station, and that's just a level of kind of narrative commitment that you don't really see from Nintendo. Like, it's not gratuitous or excessive. It's more intriguing. You see the title screen, and you're like, are those people dead? What's going on there? And, you know, there is a Metroid in the center, so if you've played, you know, Metroid games before, you recognize it, and then you get into the game and you see the same situation, but now the baby Metroid is gone. That was really well timed, just totally coincidentally to what I'm talking about. But yes, as you can see on the video behind us, this was actually a live stream that I recorded a few years ago. So if Samus looks a little clueless, that's just because that's how I play video games, very cluelessly. But it is a very different kind of game for Nintendo. I mean, what else would did they publish in that era? Like F-Zero, Mario Kart, Super Mario World, Yoshi's Island, Kirby,
yeah.
Kirby Golf, the Kirby's Dream Course. Yeah, yeah. Like, it was all pretty cartoonish and fun and colorful. And then you've got a game where there's, you know, you see dead people and there's a space dragon that smacks you with his tail. And it's pretty intense. There's like, you know, you go in to fight a boss and there's like a dead spaceman laying outside his room. It's just not what you expect to see from Nintendo in 1994, or even now. But I mean, at least now we do have more, I feel there's a more serious tone to the Zelda games, like Tears mm-hmm. of the Kingdom sure. and Breath yeah. of the Wild. But even back then, you know, A Link to the Past was very rounded and colorful and cartoonish, and Link had pink hair and the trees all looked like gumdrops. It was not an intense kind of game, even though the, you know, the plot was pretty serious.
Yeah, I mean, this was the era when people were always using the term kiddie. or maybe kind of the start of that, but that might have like started more in like late 90s, but people like clearly identify like, oh, Nintendo is the kiddie system. And, you know, not that there, obviously there's nothing wrong with the quote-unquote kiddie games. There's something
wrong. I'm grateful for the kiddie games.
Yes. I mean, there's something wrong with calling them kiddie games, I would say. But yeah, I mean, this definitely has a more intense vibe that that wasn't really expected. I don't know if this really moved the needle in terms of Nintendo's public perception in terms of like, oh, what was the mature system? What was the kiddie system? Because they really struggled with that for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, this feels a lot more serious than giving Kirby angry eyebrows on the box art. So in that sense, you know, I do think this was pretty effective counter-programming to Sega's marketing for the Genesis. You know, they were constantly putting Sonic and Mario together and saying, look at how much cooler we are. And I don't know that this necessarily did the counter-programming of, like, Nintendo games are slow, because this is a very, very methodical, slow-paced game. But it just has atmosphere and a real sense of intensity. Like, you really have to commit to it, and it doesn't take any prisoners. It's not a super challenging game, per se. You know, there's some fairly tough boss fights the first time you get to them, but the intensity is more just in terms of, you mentioned Dark Souls earlier, it's kind of that commitment. You have to like really put yourself into this game and give yourself over to it. And you know, that's a different kind of feel than you tended to get from Nintendo. And almost, I'd say it almost gets back to more of an arcade style mentality, except this is not an arcade style game. It's, you know, like with arcade games, you have to really throw yourself into them and commit and get good at patterns and, you know, recognizing where enemies were going to spawn and that sort of thing. This is not like that, but the commitment is just, you know, kind of figuring out how everything works, how the environment is designed, how you can get past certain barriers, figuring out like, okay, I have this new tool now. What am I supposed to do with it? I feel like I remember seeing something an hour and a half ago that's going to be relevant, but where was that? And just kind of making your way through, you know, that way, like, you know, kind of figuring things out based on the few clues that you have available.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like what I live for in Metroidvania-style games is that moment of, like, you've emerged from somewhere, and then you suddenly realize, like, in Super Metroid, when you come back up to Crateria, and you're like on the right hand side of your ship, and like you don't realize quite where you are at first, and then you like suddenly realize like, oh, I'm here, like that moment of like, oh, this place, and now right. There's this shortcut between these places. That's like what makes Metroidvania for me.
And even just little things, like when you do reemerge into Crateria and back to the surface, the storm from the beginning of the game is cleared, and yes. So now it's clear, so it feels
like
different.
Mm-hmm.
The music has changed. Instead of having just like ambient atmospheric sounds in the background, there's this kind of slow rising triumphant music, mm-hmm. and you feel like, oh, you know what? This intimidating, scary kind of horror situation that I initially emerged into, or, you know, descended into, it's changed now. I've become more powerful. I started to get a handle on how this works. And now I feel like a pretty cool hero.
Yeah.
And it does it right from the beginning, especially if you played the first one. We're just seeing right now in the video, when you come down and you're like, oh, this is where the first game started. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you get this idea that the planet is so much bigger mm-hmm. than it was.
Yeah, and it's also creepy, because if you remember this part from the original Metroid, you know, there were enemies and little guys crawling along the bricks and things like that. They're all gone, and now there's just like spotlights watching you, and it's it's very eerie and unsettling. But you know, even at the beginning, it plays off the original Metroid. I mean, obviously this is a sequel to Metroid 2, because they've talked about the little baby Metroid that you saved at the end of the second game. But when you go into that space station and you face off against, you know, Ridley, whoa, he's back. You immediately have to do an escape sequence, which is how the original game ended. And then Metroid 2 ends with sort of an escape sequence, but there's no stress to it at all. Like, basically, you've beaten the Queen Metroid, you have the baby tagging along behind you, and it's just clearing a path for you, and you can take your time and just sort of enjoy your way out. Here, you're like 3 minutes into the game, and all of a sudden, everything is like falling to pieces around you, steam is blasting everywhere, tiles are falling. The place is going to blow up in 60 seconds and you have to get out. So, you know, it's really kind of playing off of that. There's that energy tank up there that you can't get to because you don't have the powers yet. It was there in the original. Yeah, like that's
really rewards the people who played the first
game. You really. There was a thing that I saw. Is it going to be here again? Yes, but you know, you still can't get it because you can't quite jump that high.
Yeah, and they don't have to spend all this time explaining how Samus lost all of her equipment and stuff. They just skip over it.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, the galaxy's at peace. Why would she continue carrying the Screw Attack and Avaria? She doesn't need those. The galaxy's at peace.
Yeah, she doesn't need authorization.
Exactly. Bug off, Adam. So I'm trying to remember, does Other M take place before? No, it takes place after this.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a more peaceful, happier world. So even among other games at the time, you know, not just among Nintendo's games, but other games at the time, Super Metroid really stands out. You know, we've kind of mentioned that it's counter-programming to what Sega was doing with its Genesis marketing, but it doesn't look like a Genesis game. I mean, it's a very, like, it really takes advantage of the graphical capabilities of the Super NES, not just like, you know, parallax layers and transparencies and stuff, but just the colors. There's a lot of depth to it that you don't get in the more, you know, Genesis had a very crisp look, like very bold colors. This is a much softer, more nuanced game that really takes advantage of the, you know, the greater palette variety on the Super NES. But even on top of that, people just weren't making games like this at all
right.
in 1994. Like, how many Metroid-style, you know, exploratory platform action games can you name from the year 1994? Anyone.
Monster World 4?
Yeah.
Kind of,
but that's more linear.
Monster World 3, I mean, that would be a little earlier, but...
even then, you're not getting a lot of equipment or anything that's
right.
going to...
Right.
Yeah. Adventure Island 4, but that didn't come here. So, can we really count that?
There,
I say no.
There wasn't a lot of competition. I mean, it was such a big deal when, like, Shadow Complex came out. So many years later, like...
15 years later.
People were like, oh my gosh, like, this is just like Super Metroid, and... because people weren't, they sure are now, but people weren't making games like this for a long time. Like, no one, like, this game, it's almost like people saw how good this game was, and they, no one other than Koji Igarashi thought, like, let me try something like that.
And even
I mean, his take is very different.
But it still took him a while to come back to it a little bit after, after Symphony of the Night.
Well, and also, he was actually building off A Link to the Past. According to his own words, so even then, it's like
he just didn't want
it's
to
it's right there. There's so many connections,
blue,
but no
a map with blue rooms and white borders.
Yeah,
but yeah, the overall feel of Super Metroid is just really different from other games of the era. When you look at 1994 games, you look at and you see fighting games. You see sort of the tail end of the belt scroller that was popular with
shooters.
Double Dragon and Final Fight. You see a lot of shooters, sports games, racing games. When you see platform action games, they're very linear. Like, the Super NES and Genesis and TurboGrafx were capable of so much more than just, like, simple, you know, Super Mario style, you're in a level, you're in the next level, you're in the next level. But I think, you know, the level of design commitment and thinking that goes into creating a game this interlocking and complex was probably a little out of fashion, and people just wanted to kind of, you know, focus on the aesthetics of games and, you know, build up the graphics, build up the audio, and kind of keep things simple. And if you wanted an action RPG, you would play a top-down game like Zelda or Soul Blazer or Legend of Oasis or, you know, whatever system you wanted to play on, Dungeon Explorer, as Corey mentioned earlier.
But that's more like almost roguelike.
But I mean, still, that's kind of where this style of game went.
Yes.
So Super Metroid really stands out because it almost felt like a throwback, not just to the original Metroid, but to that little era of games in the late 80s that Metroid and games like it inspired, where you had people, especially on NES and Famicom, making all kinds of exploratory action RPGs. And I kind of look at Super Mario Brothers 3 coming out in Japan in 1988 as the point at which people said, oh, you know what? It's really good to just make a nice, straightforward action game and pack it full of good content. That's so much easier than doing these interlocking puzzle dungeon games. So let's go with that. And so Super Mario Brothers 3 kind of killed off this style of game. So that meant, you know, when Super Metroid came out, there just weren't many other games like it in kind of the atmosphere at that point. And so, you know, it stood out for that reason as well.
Yeah. You kind of got me thinking about Fazanadu, which, you know, that was, you know, another, like, kind of open-ended exploratory world. But I think something else that it shares in common with Super Metroid, something that was very uncommon on the NES and, you know, mostly uncommon on Super Nintendo as well, is that very sort of earthy, organic feel to the world. That was something that I think developers really struggled to do in those 8 and 16.
Felt lived in.
Yeah, lived in. You know, you got this, like, Star Wars or, like, Aliens.
Like a lived-in universe.
World. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like there were some games that managed to kind of move away from the sort of crisp, bright cartoon style and give you something a little more lived in, like you said. One of the ones that really kind of stood out to me, it's not necessarily a great game, but it definitely kind of catches that Metroid vibe, which is appropriate, which is Probes Alien 3, especially
for Super
NES. Yep. It's not a fully exploratory game, but, you know, within each section of the prison world, you have to kind of explore, run around, capture, or, you know, rescue prisoners, avoid aliens, kind of ration your ammo. It was challenging, and it was very that sort of, you know, had an earthy, organic feel because it was a pretty dark and grimy movie. And, you know, basing the visuals on that movie gave you a kind of dark and grimy game. So I thought that worked pretty well as sort of like an ersatz Super Metroid to kind of hold us over for a year until Super Metroid actually came out. but, you know, it still didn't compare quite to this. Like, this is a masterclass in game design. And in, you know, kind of returning to that late 80s thought of what if we did an RPG, but it was an action game? And, you know, not doing it with a top-down Zelda style, but doing it as a side-scrolling platform. And, you know, a big part of that is just how well-structured the entire world is. You know, the original Metroid, it's not one huge open world. It's one world broken into areas that are, you know, kind of interconnected by a single passageway. So you get these kind of, like, spaces that have interlinks between them. But really, once you go to Norfair or to Kraid's hideout, you're pretty much there, and you need to figure that all out. Super Metroid kind of takes that same style, but there's a lot more interlocking between the different spaces and a lot more ways to kind of navigate and travel between the different zones of the game. So it starts to bleed into the other areas. And that, you know, just in terms of designing a game, for the people who were making it, that's really difficult to do and to pull it off and to make it effective. And it's not, I don't think it's quite perfect because there are ways to sequence break that maybe weren't intended, but they just about pulled it off nearly perfectly, and it's very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I think that interconnectedness is a big part of what makes the whole thing come together. That's what separates it from a lot of other games. Before the term Metroidvania came around, I used to say, or search action, that's the preferred term.
It's not. It's Metroidvania.
I'm still...
Please look forward to my book, Metroidvania, where it's coming in 2025.
I still don't think it's fair to call this like a Metroidvania, because it's just a Metroid game. Because it existed before.
Yeah. But I used to use the term one big level. Like, I also referred to say, like, Resident Evil. That's a one big level game, you know? Kind of a silly way to put it. But, like, I saw that interconnectedness as being the key feature to what made Metroid Metroid, what made Metroidvania or Egovania a Egovania, not a Classicvania. And I think a lot of people, I don't think you see this argument much anymore, but there used to be a lot of debate a decade or two ago, can it be a Metroidvania or a Metroid-like game if your progression is not dictated by abilities? People would say, like, oh, you know, you get the green key card or something. That's not Metroidvania because your progression is just a key, not expanded abilities. And I don't think so. I think to me, it's that interconnected level design that really defines it. But I think the expansion of exploration potential through abilities is probably the most interesting way to do it. And that's very much what Super Metroid does.
One of the things that really defines Metroid is that Samus herself is all the tools, all the keys, all the inventory that you need. She acquires abilities throughout the game, but you're not like going into a menu and saying, okay, now it's time to, you know, like in Zelda, where you're like, well, I've got to fight Goma, so I need to switch over to the bow and arrow and activate that and put that on my action buttons. You don't have that here. Like, there is a menu in this game where you can toggle some of her powers, but it's just like, which gun do I want active? Do I want the freeze beam on, or do I want to switch to, you know, like turn it off so I don't have to shoot things as many times to blow them up? Otherwise, though, once Samus gains abilities, those are the keys that she needs to access new areas. I mean, you've seen the colored doors throughout this video, and each of those, there's like this really, it's not realistic, but it's color coding that's very effective for saying, like, in order to get past this door, you're going to need a tool that you don't have now. And then that tool turns out to be a new missile or a bomb or something. And it's, you know, not only are you able to explore more of the world, but you can navigate the world more easily because Samus is now more powerful and can take on enemies and, you know, approach them in different ways. And so it's building up her strength, but also building up the size of the world and giving you access to more of the world. So there's this really great sort of parallel evolution, parallel growth within Metroid, Super Metroid especially, where the more powerful you become, the more the world opens up to you on multiple levels. And again, it's a masterclass in game design, and so many other people have tried to copy that and duplicate that. And they're not always successful because it's really challenging, really tricky. It requires a lot of, I think, trial and error. And, you know, this is another reason this is unique among Nintendo games is because the development team spent like 18 months on it, which people did not do back then. Like, games did not, they were not in development for that long. You know, development on games was like 3 to 6 months. But they spent a lot of time really just hashing over this game and getting it right in a way that was very uncommon, even at Nintendo. And it really shows.
You never feel, you know, like it's overcomplicated, which is, you know, I think a downfall of a lot of current Metroidvanias is there's just so much going on and the world is so big. But here, it's, you never feel, like you feel excited about exploring more so than like, oh geez, like here's that dot now, like way in the middle of nothingness, how do I get there? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think Axiom Verge is a good example of, it's like, okay, we've got this controller with 4 face buttons, 4 shoulder buttons, right stick, left stick.
You gotta use everything.
Click sticks. Like, let's put something on every single button.
You know,
obviously, the relative simplicity of the controller, like, kind of helped them sort of streamline the design and not overthink, like what are all the things we could do in this game? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't use the shoulder buttons for alternate weapons. They used the shoulder buttons to allow you to more easily aim at angles, which is, you know, a little tricky sometimes. It allows you to do things like duck and shoot upward at a 45-degree angle, which would be impossible just with a D-pad. So there's a lot of really good thought that went into kind of the way the game works. But yeah, like, another great thing they did with the weapons and the tools and everything is that when you acquire something new, you have to use it immediately. Like, it drops you into a space where the only way you can get out is to turn on that weapon, make use of it, and then that immediately gives you a tutorial saying, when you encounter something that looks like this, or a scenario where you find yourself stuck like that, you need to use the tool that you've just acquired. And so it sticks in your mind really well. And a lot of games, you know, like Guacamelee and Shadow Complex that have, you know, come after Super Metroid and worked in its you know, kind of to try to duplicate its magic, have correctly recognized, like, that is a great way to hand out powers and a great way to create a seamless tutorial. You don't have to, like, put signs up and say, now you have a new weapon.
Yes.
Even Metroid games haven't always done that. Actually, now, you know, like, Nintendo has forgotten, the same developers have forgotten their own experiences, or just they don't have the confidence in the audience to figure things out.
Teach through level design, not words. That's always the best way, I think.
Yeah, I mean, everything in Super Metroid happens without words. You get the intro where Samus tells you that the galaxy is at peace and Ceres Station is under attack, so maybe not so peaceful. And after that, there's no more dialogue. Even through the end of the game, you know, the ending, the very dramatic ending that's very memorable and actually a little moving if you've played Metroid 2, it all is pantomime. There's no dialogue, there's no words, there's no narrative, but it's totally clear what's happened and what you need to do. And even throughout the game, there's so much environmental storytelling. If you really pay attention to what's happening, you start to see this world where nothing is given to you explicitly, nothing is explained to you, but you can piece together the mysteries and kind of say, like, oh, there's stuff that I didn't see in the original Metroid, and now it's here. I wonder what that's about.
And that's something that only video games can do effectively. So that's something that I like to see done in video games, is just, like, storytelling through the environment. It's very hard to do that in a movie or a book, or, you know, I mean, you know, maybe with some sort of visual novel you could do something like that, but, like, that's something that, like, is very uniquely video games, so I think it's good for them to explore that. And this was, I mean, was there any game before this that did that so successfully, or even really tried it as directly as this game did?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely played, you know, games on NES even, where you would come across things in the environment and they tie into, like, the boss fight ahead. So, you know, there definitely was some of that, but not to the level that Super Metroid really embraces it. Because, you know, the game begins with the baby Metroid being captured by Ridley and whisked away, spirited away to some place back on planet Zebes. And you don't know exactly why, but if you're really paying attention as you play, you can kind of start to piece things together. You know, it's pretty clear by the end of it that the space pirates who captured the baby Metroid have been trying to clone it, to experiment on it and figure out what its properties are. I mean, there's a little bit of a breadcrumb given at the beginning of the game where Samus says, you know, the researchers were trying to explore the Metroid's ability to generate energy, but the space pirates have gone above and beyond that. So once you get into the Meridia zone of the game, there's an entire section that just appears to be a laboratory. And when you're playing, at some point you encounter what appear to be Metroids, but they're not. They're
Mock-Troids.
But it's clearly it's like some sort of attempt to clone the Metroids. When you go into the space pirate ship, once you turn the power on, you know, if you've wondered, like, what is this crashed ship doing here? When you turn the power back on, not only does it bring the robots and the defense systems back to life, but also monitors, and you see, like, on the monitors, there's, like, fragmented video of Metroids, and you start to, like, say, were they trying to, you know, transport a Metroid? Is this where the Metroid came from? Like, it broke loose, and like in the movie Alien, and caused the ship to crash. Is that the story behind Planet Zebes in the first place? None of that is actually explained, and it leaves it all to your imagination and for you to kind of put together your own theories. And I think that's, you know, that helps build the appeal of the game, because people are still speculating about it. And you go to, you know, forums and fan discussions, and every time a new Metroid game comes out, you know, once every 20 years or so, people sit down and are, like, you know, trying to piece together what they saw in Super Metroid, you know, comparing it to Metroid Prime, comparing it to Metroid Fusion, comparing it to Metroid Dread, and trying to tie all these things together. And there's so much here that's intriguing, and it lays the, you know, it kind of plants seeds, but it doesn't give it to you, like, you know, just verbatim. And so it just leaves that little thing festering in your mind and wondering as you continue to play, and you go back and you think, oh, is this like that thing I saw in Super Metroid?
I love that they have never explained that, too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Metroid Zero Mission kind of explained it, and that was very unsatisfying, and I wish they hadn't done that. But, you know, it is what it is.
I think something that they do very effectively with that as well with, like, you know, the slow reveal of, like, what happened in Metroids and stuff. You know, you were talking about where the Mach Droids are when you're in Meridia. Like, I don't know if it's necessarily the... I don't know if you have to go through this first, but there's this, like, very quick, like, elevator shoot ride, and you, like, pass through, and you get, like, if you blink, you would not see it, but you see these Metroids, and you're like, wait, was that Metroids? Like, they've always done such a good job of... And those Mach Droids are very weak once you actually encounter them, but actual Metroids, they've generally always done a very good job of, like, holding them back to the point where, like, you're, like, really intimidated by the time you get to them because they're so built up in your mind. You're like, these are scary, bad things. And, you know, you're... I think it's scary when you actually first encounter real Metroids in most Metroid games. Yeah. Like, they do, like, kind of overuse them in some of them to where they actually aren't scary anymore, but...
I mean, there are a lot of horror aspects to the game.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, this series was very much inspired by the movie Alien and Aliens, and it really shows. I mean, they do a great job of kind of giving you that whole, like, here is an existential horror that's going to suck onto you and kill you, and you know, how can you destroy it?
It's great in the end when you run into the corpses and you touch them and they are, like, just turned to dust because all the life energy has been sucked from them.
No, you know, even Metroid 2, which is a pretty checkered game, a little rocky. Like, it keeps building the Metroids to be more powerful and more and more powerful. So you fight, like, the first evolution all the way up through, like, the final evolution of Metroids. And, you know, they're just basically missile sponges. You just keep blasting missiles into them, and they soak up damage. And then at the very end of the game, a bunch of new Metroids hatch, and they're, like, the classic Metroids, and you have to rethink how you approach facing those guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the same thing here. Like, you go into the final Taurian zone, and it's basically a straight reprise of the original Metroid.
Yeah.
And you do have more armaments, more options to face off against the Metroids than you did in the original Metroid. Like, if you went into Taurian in the original Metroid with just the wave beam and not the ice beam, you were pretty much SOL. I think in theory you can make it through, but I wouldn't recommend it. But here, you know, you have the wave beam and the ice beam, so you've got the wavy ice beam, and that's awesome.
Then you also have super missile. You can kill them with one hit with that.
Yeah, and so, like, you face the Metroids and they're tough, but you start to think, okay, this isn't as bad as it was in the original Metroid. And then, you know, you come into a room where there are no enemies, just everything is crumbly dust, and that little guy jumps onto the screen and a giant Metroid comes in and destroys it, and then you panic. You're like, whoa, what am I supposed to do here? Like, this, how am I supposed to even fight that? And it gives you enough time to kind of, like, start to run around and figure out, like, where do I go? How can I get out of here? And the doors are locked. And it rises and kind of looks around, and then, or, you know, I guess you're anthropomorphizing it here because it's just a jellyfish. But you get the sense that it's looking around and sees you and is like, oh, here's the after-dinner mint. So it's a really great moment where it kind of, the game lulls you into a false sense of security before the big final showdown. And it's, again, great narrative, great game design, just everything firing on all cylinders. Another note that I have here in my notes is that there are many ways to play Super Metroid. This maybe is where we talk about what the hell is Shine Sparking.
You kept talking about it.
Yeah, something.
The last time I was playing Super Metroid while I was traveling here yesterday, the last time that I played it before then was actually a stream playing a randomizer. And that perhaps soured me on certain things a little bit more than it would have otherwise, because, you know, like, the high jump boots didn't come until way late into the game, so there were a lot of places I had to wall jump out of, shine spark out of, really annoying stuff. Yeah, I'm not too much of, like, into, like, the whole speed run sorts of ways of playing games. I like to play very vanilla, very straightforward. I've actually always thought it's a little bit strange that such a mainstay of the series is getting 100% within, you know, a short amount of time to get the quote-unquote the best ending, even though it, you know, it's usually not much more than you see more of Samus, right? But I feel like that whole... I don't understand why it's such a mainstay in the series, because, like, to me, it's an exploratory game, a game where you want to take your time, and I feel like encouraging the player to rush it is antithetical to what it's about. So I have done it. I have done it in the past. I've kind of forgotten my way around a lot of parts of the game, but I have, like, you know, 100% in 2 hours or whatever it is to get the best ending. But it takes practice. And there is a satisfaction in learning your way through it, but I still feel like it goes against what that first playthrough kind of encourages you.
Well, I don't think anybody's rushing through in 3 hours in their first.
No, it just gives
you something else to shoot for.
I mean, it adds replay value, certainly, but that whole, like, speed run aspect of it has always struck me as a little strange, but that's just me.
Yeah, I feel like that's actually a great choice they made with this game, is a way to encourage you to keep playing it. Because, you know, the original Metroid, if you played it and you completed it in a certain amount of time, then you got to continue playing, like to do a fresh playthrough, but with all your powers carried over, and also Samus looks different now. So it was a chance for you to kind of play it and take it in a different way. That disappeared with Metroid 2, but it did explicitly say, here's how long it took for you to complete the game. The original just kind of kept that as a hidden value. This game, you know, says, here's how long it took you. Also, here's all the stuff you missed. Maybe you want to go back and explore more of the world because you only got 67% of the items. That means you missed a third of the things in this game. You should go back and play some more. So it's encouraging you to continue playing it. And, you know, by giving you the time, it gives you a little bit of that kind of arcade spirit to continue mastering it and to continue, you know, racing through it. I don't know if Nintendo Power, you know, they would always post high scores. I don't know if they did, like, best times on Metroid, Super Metroid. But this is kind of, in some ways, the game that sort of laid the foundation for speedrunning. I can't think of any game before this that said, here's the percentage of what you found, and here is the amount of time it took for you to do that. If someone out there can think of something that predates Super Metroid that did that, please shout it out. But I've spent a lot of time, like, trying to look through and find something along those lines, and there just wasn't. So this really, maybe sort of unintentionally, laid the foundation for an entire internet subculture that would pop up, you know, 10 years later when people started doing speed runs. I remember, you know, literally 10 years later, watching these early videos of people using glitches and stuff to get through Castlevania and Super Mario Brothers in record time. And, you know, it was just, again, this game that was kind of ahead of its time and really thinking in ways of, you know, how are some interesting design elements that we can add to this to keep people playing, to give them incentive to continue playing, even though you can't, like, jump into a new game with all your powers, you know, intact, because it would break the sequence. But if you want to replay this very sort of structured, well thought out adventure again and get something out of it, what better way than to encourage people to poke into every corner and to see how efficiently they can get through the game and you know, how much of it they can complete in that amount of time.
One of the rooms that you just passed through in the video here is actually one of the places where I would say is probably, like, an intended sequence break. You didn't do it in the video.
But
when you enter that one room, there's a block right above you, and if you know how to wall jump, most people probably wouldn't know how to wall jump that first time through the game, but if you knew how to... further back, where you're expected to have the high jump boots to jump up, and then you can go to the right, and I think it's the spazer.
This room, okay.
Right, so you can actually wall jump up there.
Yep.
And I remember, like, feeling very satisfied.
I tried it in the stream, and it didn't work, and I was like, well, this is going to be really boring for everyone watching if I just keep fumbling it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's, like, a couple of things that's...
I mean, that's the tube right there, the tunnel. That is an all-time
classic.
You know, when I was playing it, you know, like, I didn't have... you know, the internet. So it was completely crazy to me to just, like, I'm going to try certain things, like using the bomb in the tube. And I was shocked that it worked.
Yeah, if you haven't played the game, one, I'm sorry we're spoiling everything. It's really cool, but you should play it anyway. But, you know, there are these glass tubes that run through Brinstar and connect different spaces. And they're surrounded by water. And, you know, the first time you pass through them, you think, this is probably just like a cool environmental detail. It's neat. But once you actually get to the Meridia underwater zone, you pass those tunnels, those tubes, and there is like this connection between Meridia and Brinstar that is not explicit, you know, in terms of the tunnels and elevators that normally connect you between zones. And
it's like a broken one at one point. Yeah.
Yes, and I don't think the game shows this in the attract mode, but if you use a power bomb in there, not a normal bomb, but like the upgraded bomb, you can shatter that tube and create an instant shortcut, which, you know, early in the game, it doesn't really matter because you don't have the gravity suit that you need because Samus is her own tools. You need the gravity suit to navigate underwater. Otherwise, you can't really jump high. But once you have the gravity suit, then, you know, that's a really quick shortcut, a really easy way to get between that zone instead of having to loop all the way back around up through Upper Meridia into the pirate ship and then, you know, through Criteria and back into Brinstar.
Yeah, it's a really cool. I mean, it's just one of the best moments in the game. But, you know, they also do kind of telegraph it a little bit because I'm pretty sure that that little tube section is part of the Meridia map. That's probably the first dot that you make on the Meridia map. And then eventually you'll realize, like, oh, there's this gap in Brinstar. I passed through there. What's this? Oh, it's a separate zone. And that kind of, like, plants the seeds of, like, how can I break into here, right?
But I mean, looking at it from a point where I, you know, I didn't even know what the dots meant when I first played it. I didn't know that it meant that there were items in there because I had, there's nothing that tells you that that's what it means.
Mm-hmm. Well, the game, you know, in addition to giving you a map, it does make a lot of design choices that make for a friendlier experience than the original Metroid. Mm-hmm. You know, you have an in-game map, but also you have those dots, and also at some point you get the X-ray beam, which you don't need to complete the game. But one of the most tedious parts of the original Metroid was just bombing and shooting every single surface, hoping to find passages.
Yeah.
And with the X-ray beam, you don't have to do that. You can stop, scan around, say, oh, okay, like I need the power missile to get through there so I can launch the power missile.
Yeah, use the power bomb and it will reveal all the blocks that can be destroyed.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
I mean, once you, you get the X-ray beam before the power bombs if you play normally.
But that's it's all stuff that we've learned from experience of playing games over the years. Like, oh, I can just do that.
Right.
And you know, when I was playing it the first time, I just had no idea. Yeah, I never played anything like it.
There's so much that you can do that you don't know about because the game does not explicitly say, you can do this. And none of that is necessary to get through the game. But once you figure those things out, it just makes the game more enjoyable. And that ties again into the, you know, the speed run, the timing, the percentage complete. It lets you just, you know, tackle the game on your own terms and play the way you want to play, and it gives you more tools for exploring. And there's no way that anyone would beat the game with 100% completion on their own the first time they play. Like, even if you're super thorough and explore carefully, there are some really, really tricky spots. There is like one or two missiles, I think, in Meridia that you need to Shine Spark to get to. And we still haven't even mentioned what Shine Sparking actually is. Try, you gotta give it to us.
Shine Sparking is when you use the correct term. You know, you have to hold the button down. I map dash to A. And, you know, once you reach a certain amount of speed that you can break through dash blocks, if you hold down, like Samus, like, stores the energy in her, and you can walk around for a short time, and you can then either, depending on what direction you hold the D-pad, you can either just shoot straight up. That's like the normal Shine Spark. But you can also go laterally, which...
You can go diagonally, actually.
See, that's
It's really hard, but you can do it.
It's a very awkward combination of inputs of like, okay, I need to dash but not fire off, or I need to jump but not fire off the Shine Spark to do, like, get lined up to where I want to go. It's very complicated, very technical. I kind of don't like it.
It's heavy reliance on future games, you know, like in Zero Mission, to get so many items, like, made it so that I didn't want to get 100% in it.
Right, and Metroid Dread, and also games like AM2R, you know, very much leans into what, like, the speedrunners really like. They really like Shine Sparking. Me, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
But again, you don't have to do any of that in this game. Like, you don't have to master the Shine Spark.
No.
But if you do, you can explore like the upper areas of Criteria early and, you know, get a couple extra missiles and an energy tank that you wouldn't normally be able to get until you get the space jump. Yeah. So, if you know, it's kind of built-in sequence breaking through hidden abilities and secret powers. So, again, it gets into that speedrun thing. Like, before there was speedrunning, and it was just Super Metroid's designers thinking ahead, like, what are some cool things we can do to expand the replayability of this game and you know, like, encourage people to revisit it and to take new approaches to replaying Super Metroid.
Yeah.
And I think...
And I wonder if they knew, if they knew that they were making something so special when they were when they were doing that. Or they just wanted to make something better than the previous two.
I think maybe both. I mean, I feel like you don't get to spend 18 months making a game in a six-month development cycle if there isn't some confidence that this is really something different and unique.
Yeah, and, you know, it kind of makes me think of something like, say, Breath of the Wild. Like, it was so impactful when it came out, and I thought, like, oh, in 2 or 3 years, every game's going to be Breath of the Wild. And then you have all of these open-world games on more powerful systems that don't actually do all of the very interactive sorts of environmental things that it does. And I think it was the same thing with Super Metroid, where it's like, this game seems so influential, but it almost seemed like so big, so well done, people were afraid to maybe copy it for a long time. And then, you know, when the indie era came, everyone's like, okay, I have to make my own tribute to Super Metroid, because that's just what an impact it had on, you know, players and today's game design.
Yeah, and they never came back to it themselves for like 6-7 years, right? Until 2001.
Yeah, they totally skipped the N64 era.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that an N64 Super Metroid would have been super satisfying.
No, yeah, but you know, it'd be horrible probably.
I mean, at the same time, I would say, like, since I didn't really know much about Metroid up to that point when, like, Smash Brothers came out, I think just the mere fact that Samus was included in that, like, really was like, oh, okay, like, so she's a big deal. Like, I want to play her game now. Same thing with Earthbound. You know, I'm glad that it taught me about Earthbound, you know, back when that game was $35. so, you know, I think the fact that Nintendo has put Samus in that prominent position was a big part of what kept her alive and what kept players curious to play her games, and could be part of what brought her, you know, created the demand that brought her back in Metroid Prime.
Yeah, I think we're actually beyond our time limit. It's 10 till, right? So we probably ought to wrap up, but I am going to let the video run until everyone can see Kraid, because he's so cool in this game.
One of my favorite parts. I mean, it's so impressive, but I really like that, you know, if you back up like a few seconds, where you see the baby Kraid, which is like the same size as Kraid as in the original. And then you
shoot him in a single shot, and he dies, and you're like, oh. But that was also in the original Metroid. There was the fake Kraid just, like, hanging out. There's a body being eaten by space bugs. Yeah. Oh, it's horrible. It's not Nintendo.
You know, like, this is... Like, the size of Kraid was the thing that sold me on the game.
K-Rad, as my friends like to call him. K-Rad and R-Diddles.
R-Diddles, wow. You had some interesting friends. All right, well, the adults are not here to chase us out, but I feel like we should be responsible, and I know there are other panels that are happening. People have places to go. So I think we will wrap up our tribute to Super Metroid here, but I will say that, you know, 30 years on, this game is still awesome. It's still, you know, a high watermark for 16-bit game design. It's incredibly influential, you know, not only in terms of indie games, but also in terms of professional, quote-unquote, games, you know, packaged, marketed games. Like, they've kind of come around to copying the style, to taking notes from Super Metroid. And I don't think any game will ever recapture the experience of playing Super Metroid in 1994. But I do appreciate the fact that other game developers are trying to kind of recapture some of that magic in their own ways. You know, I'm not a big fan of Hollow Knight, but I think for a lot of people, Hollow Knight really captures the sense of, like, I am lost, I'm helpless, what's going on in this huge, confusing world? And, you know, there are other ways to capture that, but that's one that definitely honed in on the, like, here's a massive world where you have no idea what you're supposed to do, go figure it out. And it's fun to see so many developers continue to iterate on this one game concept. Yeah. And build on it and improve on it in ways that its own creators, you know, don't necessarily think to duplicate.
Yeah.
So, there's something special about Super Metroid, and 30 years from now, when we're all very old and this game is 60, I'm still going to be talking about how much it rocked.
Yes.
Maybe even here.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
All right, thanks everyone. Thanks Corey and Tri. And of course, players, see you next mission.